Well, again, it's been an inspiring night talking to you and all the others, and then to hear the young brothers and sisters, all three of them. I thought of course, we had Sister Brianna on just a little few days ago on our show, but they're really laying bare the undeniable failures of predatory capitalism in its highly financialized form, and its connections to the white male supremacies and homophobias and transphobias. And it's refreshing.
I can hear them,
hear
but
their
can't
voices
hear me.
To speak those kinds of truths. Very unpopular, for some controversial, others even scandalous, but I think they're speaking the truth, and they've got to continue to speak. They really do.
Yeah, that's entirely true. They have to continue that. That's really true. And it's appalling that there isn't a real political home for that kind of critique.
Absolutely. Because you think, see, in my generation, you know, we had a whole slice of us who did benefit as persons who gained access to the middle class of the economic boom of the transatlantic capitalist expansion. Whereas young folk now, the last 40 years of wage stagnation, unemployment, no health care unless you have a job, unbelievable student debt. And so their experience of predatory capitalism was one of massive failure.
Exactly.
And that's very different
right.
for somebody in my generation. Between 1945 and 73, we had the capitalist expansion. Now, we know that it did reinforce steel, you know, inequality and so forth. And that's why Brother Martin was so right to talk about the poverty and wealth inequality. But now these young folks, and Sister Brianna, I'll tell you, she's speaking some serious truths that are challenging to the establishment.
Yeah. I mean, this generation is really the fodder. You know, they don't reap the rewards of that expansion.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I thought
yeah.
I saw Sister Connie, though. Did you see Sister
me
Connie?
Me too. Hopefully she'll come back and we can chat with Sister Connie Rice.
Absolutely.
Hopefully.
Well, I think they're working it out.
Yeah, they'll work it out. Well, we'll wait on her and see what happens. But
absolutely. But I tell you, last time she was on.
Yeah, you know,
it's you're talking about a truth teller, Sister Connie.
Civil rights lawyer, former member of Obama's task force, author of Power Concedes Nothing. Which, you know, we can see that in motion right now.
Isn't that the truth?
And there she is.
Can you hear me?
How are you?
We can hear you. How are you doing out there, sister?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear your lovely voice.
Okay, I can't see you, but I can hear your wonderful voices, so we'll go with that.
Oh, we can see your lovely face and hear your wonderful voice, though.
My condolences.
How are you doing?
it's so good to hear the two of you. Voices of sanity.
Yep. We miss you. I've been wondering what you've been thinking through all of this today and all the other debates since our previous discussion. How are you feeling now, and what are you thinking about where we are, and are you on the brink of dread here?
No, I'm not. not the kind of dread you're talking about. the fear that the megalomaniac pyromaniac might get reelected. But we got to get rid of this crime family before we can even set reset. This period, somebody asked me, what is it that we're going through? And it's so clear to me that we're fighting the last battles of the American Civil War. And we haven't won the American Civil War. It's the longest war in this country's history. And this is the fourth national reckoning over white dominance and white supremacy. The first was at the founding of the nation. He came up with 3/5 of a man. The second was the Civil War and to preserve the Union, they ended slavery. But then they reinstituted slavery light. So there's always a when there's a national reckoning, people of color aren't in the conversation. We're the object of the conversation, but really it's a discussion amongst white Americans about how much with how much racism are we comfortable now? And each answer at each reckoning, it's a few, it gets better. But then there's a huge backlash. There's a redemption of white supremacy in the wake of each reckoning. You have the Civil War, then you have 12 years of Reconstruction, you end Reconstruction, you reinstitute slavery light, the Black Codes, the rise of Klan terror and complete suppression. And then you fast forward to the third reckoning, and it's the Civil Rights Revolution. And the country decides to end savage brutality with impunity, and that we have in the South and still in pockets still do. So they agreed to end brutality, but they did not agree to bring in equality. And we fast forward to, and so there, after you pass some civil rights laws, voting rights, housing rights, and the few civil rights laws that were passed in the wake of King's murder, you have 50 years of retraction of those meager advances. So then you have the first African-American president, and the fourth reckoning is what we're going through now. White Americans are trying to decide how much white nationalism are we comfortable with. And what's astonishing is, no, it's not astonishing. It's what's disappointing is that still in the 21st century, 53% of eligible white voters are fine with Trump, fine with white nationalism, lying.
That's what the data says for tonight, so far.
Yeah, and until that early vote, because that massive early vote is what's going to determine what happens in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. That's his Rust Belt blue wall, Biden's Rust Belt blue wall. So I have no sense of this race yet, and won't until probably Friday. But what's astonishing is that this is like a choice between Mr. Rogers and Caligula. And over half the country thinks it's a choice to choose Caligula. Now, That's getting beyond the racism and the cruelty and the craven corruption and the trashing of the Madisonian framework. Whatever you think of the Madisonian framework, try vindicating the rights of poor people and people of color without even the hope of ever achieving the Madisonian framework. As I said to people, if you think it's hard to vindicate African-American rights and the rights of people of color, the rights of the disabled, the rights of LGBT, you think the rights of marginalized and discarded populations is difficult in this oligarchy that we have, that it's at least has a couple of documents that are pointing in the right direction if you ever achieve them. We haven't even begun to achieve them. We've gone back, and we're now, I really see it as an oligarchy. And in an oligarchy, you find the good oligarchs and hope you can hang on long enough. But we've gone so far back. We've had a reactionary throwback that has destroyed that framework, the rule of law, the separation of powers, all of those constitutional norms that make that Madisonian framework at least viable and you can operate in it. That's what lawyers do. We operate within it. Once that goes, you're not even going to be able to get back to where we were when with the establishment dynamics. That's what we're doing. We're clawing our way back to the establishment. There's not even anything on the horizon that I think where we can actually reach the issues that your previous guests were so eloquently talking about. So it's a very strange place to be. This is damage control. It's hard to tell poor African Americans and poor Latinos, you really have to get out and vote for this particular party as damage control. It's not a vote to achieve anything that's on our agenda, because this isn't about policy. That's what I had to understand. you know, if this were about policy, Bernie Sanders would be it. This has nothing to do with policy. This is about raw power to preserve supremacy. And it's not about solving problems. It's not about meeting the needs of people anybody cares about. It's not even about the needs of Trump voters. They're, you know, they've lost their rural hospitals under this man. They're about to get completely steamrolled and wood chipped by a pandemic that they've been told is a hoax. And a lot of them just don't care because it's an emotional affect that says we don't even care if we lose our health care. As long as we own the libs, as long as the people on liberal television and the elites, as long as their hair is on fire and they're outraged and scandalized, we're happy. We just want to stick a finger in the eye of the people who have made us feel less than and who have erased us and have created a game in which we cannot win. Now, who else? What other population does that sound like? Underclass African Americans as cannot win. Cannot win in this game that determines the distribution of public wealth, the distribution of opportunity, the distribution of access to any kind of life that you can dream of. So I'm as a political junkie, I'm just gonna get my gin and tonic and go to bed and wake up on Friday and figure out who won.
You said he goes to sleep 2 days.
can't determine anything now. But the folks who live and breathe the crosstabs, you know, Doc, you and Rose, you're the scholars. I'm not a scholar. I'm a pseudo intellectual.
You're not pseudo at all.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm utilitarian. I'm not curious enough to actually do the footnotes and write the books. You all are amazing to me. You live, you know, I look for the scholars whose footnotes have footnotes. You know, I want the folks who live, breathe, and have nightmares about this stuff. I want the political consultants who eat cross tabs for breakfast, okay? I know they're going to have the gestalt, right? So just the political junkie for a minute. The reason I'm waiting is that this is such a strange, there's never been a race like this ever. So you can't really use the past algorithms to kind of predict what's happening, right? And that was also the case in 16, because I called my ex-husband, who's, I was the problem. I'm sure you have a hard time imagining that. He's still my best friend and my best expert. And I called him and I said, okay, so past polling is 50 years of the previous experiences. The previous experiences don't have anything to do with today. He says, that's right. I said, so Trump has a chance of winning? He said, no, darling, Trump is going to win. So those are the folks I like to talk to. They're never wrong. They're never wrong. And this time, if you look at the Carvilles and the Charlie Cooks and my ex and Jason Johnson and you know, Heilman, the folks who really can dig into down to the plaque tile, you know? It's the physics of this still feel like we can at least end the criminal enterprise of the Trump corruption, and that to me, that's the path. That's why Bernie Sanders is like, nothing else can get done until this. And that was also, but it's an astonishing thing. I don't know what the two of you think. And when I look at the Trump voter, I see a couple of, it's a reactionary. It's not conservative, it's reactionary. And they're reacting to what? Because it's not about objectively ascertainable fact. It's not about policy. It's not about solving a problem. It's not about facts. It's not about law. It's about none of the things that the three of us operate in, right? Truth requires fact, and wisdom requires truth. And right now, all of that's been thrown out the window. That's not what this is about. This is about power and loss of status, and about the fact that the folks who were in the Poor People's Campaign when King was alive. And the Poor People's Campaign, if I remember right, was brought by Cesar Chavez and the whole labor, you know, I'm forgetting my history, but that Poor People's Campaign had poor whites and poor blacks and poor Latinos and poor people of every race in the boat together. And that's completely destroyed. That grand alliance that King talked about is the only way to transform this capitalist system into something that at least hasn't ends the necropolitics, the politics of death, which is what we have right now, takes it back to at least a viable functioning politics that allows maybe 10% of the time some problem solving and some policy to help people. 90% of it is about increasing the power and the money of the unmovable and entrenched institutions defense the defense industrial complex, the prison industrial complex.
But one thing I think is important to keep in mind is that in 1968, that turbulent year, what Brother Martin was trying to do, very much what William Barber and Sister Thea Harris are trying to do with the Poor People's Campaign, George Wallace got 12.8% of the vote. And see, those are Trump's people too. But the big difference was that Wallace couldn't get Wall Street. He couldn't get the Pentagon. He couldn't get the corporate elites at the highest level to get behind him. So Nixon still won that. Nixon had those folks. But when you got Wall Street and the militarists, the marketeers tied to the wars, and then the social base of a George Wallace, and then slices of our brown brothers and sisters, it looks like, then you got a right-wing alliance that is, as you say, reactionary, based on a contempt for neoliberal rule, neoliberal elites, wherever they are, New York Times, Washington Post, Harvard, Yale, whatever it is, and then such a weak and feeble left. Now, we were strong with Bernie, but we get crushed by the neoliberal unity and the neoliberal coming together, right? So that the only alternative for these folk is the very establishment that they hate, who make them feel less than, who speak down to them. And then the deep racism, because white supremacy is always going to be the public face of it. This is the United States.
Right. And you push that button.
You always got, some George Wallace people.
That button.
No, go right ahead, though, Christian.
Yeah, no, that button is eminently pushable. It's, ready for action. But two quick things. One is that we have Kashama Sawant, who's joining us shortly for a few minutes.
Oh, hi, Kashama. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Glad you're here. And I just wanted to add very quickly before I introduce her, that, the other thing that plays a role in everything you so astutely have said, you've been saying, Connie, and also Cornell, is the role of conspiracy theories and the role of the internet and social media to create a huge gap between the notion of fact and the notion of basically no gap between fact and fiction, that people believe what they want to believe, that there are no sources, there's no way to prove whatever it is. And the moment you ask for proof, you're asking for footnotes, which means you're asking for some neoliberal elite evidence bag. And so you're basically, any challenge to that is rendered with tremendous amounts of skepticism. And that is, I think, really fueling the very thing that you all have been saying here. I think it's another piece of the puzzle that was not available 50 years ago, as part of it.
That's right.
But I don't want to hold off too long because Kashama's here, Council Member Kashama Sawant, and thank you for joining us. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you for having me.
Oh, fantastic. No, we're thrilled to have you. This is fantastic. So we've just been talking with our distinguished colleague, lawyer and activist Connie Rice, about the sort of state of the election, what we're thinking about, how we think about what to do the day after, or maybe Friday, which is when I think at least Connie's waking up. I might try to stay in the bed till Friday, my darn self. That's a great idea. But what are you thinking? How have you been dealing with this whole evening? And, what were your expectations? What are your thoughts? So on and so forth.
Yeah, as Connie was saying actually earlier, you know, Florida, Texas, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, so many of these states are so close to call, and it's obvious that millions of working people and youth around the country are fearfully watching this election that should not have been too close to call, and are hoping for a decisive defeat of this deeply reactionary, anti-worker, racist president. And, you know, honestly, there's also a worry about a potential repeat of 2016 and facing a drawn-out battle in which Trump and the right wing try every trick in the book to steal the election. And this is in spite of 100 million early votes and an unprecedented voter turnout. So I think in terms of your question, it's absolutely important what we do in the next 2 days. My organization, Socialist Alternative, for example, is organizing protests for tomorrow night across the country saying don't let Trump steal the election. That's why it's important that some unions are talking about strike action if needed. The California Teachers Association is currently saying that the labor movement cannot accept another 2000-style stolen election, and some are even discussing a general strike if necessary, including in Seattle. And if necessary, we need to shut the system down to stop this. If Trump steps up his efforts, you know, we know Trump's campaign has assembled an army of lawyers. Some of your speakers were talking about this. They've launched 40 lawsuits around the country. 10 million robocalls went out telling people to, quote, stay home and stay safe, end quote, which was, you know, trying to deceive them into not voting. So we have to take the potential attempts by Trump and the right wing to sabotage the vote very seriously and go all out to defend the democratic process. But the other part of this is, of course, the analysis. I mean, it says a great deal about the thoroughly corporate Biden campaign and the Democratic Party that this election is close. And again, it's, you know, the Democrats went all out to crush Bernie Sanders. And if they hadn't, we wouldn't be facing this right now. Because, we, you know, let's face it, Bernie would like very likely not have been in this situation that Biden is in tonight in a close race with a historically abysmal president, because the campaign that Bernie was running on, a political revolution against the billionaire class, had enormous potential to energize and unite large sections of working people and young people. And in short, Bernie would have won. And so we cannot forget that this was exactly this pro-wealthy position, pro-corporate position of the Democratic Party that made millions of ordinary people either disenchanted from politics entirely or fodder for the Republicans and the right wing, because people are correctly angry at the status quo, but there's no alternative to the big business parties. You know, it was no coincidence that the Tea Party developed under Obama, as Obama bailed out the banks rather than working people during the Great Recession. You had Breonna Joy Gray talk about the toll that the Great Recession took on so many millennials. And so I think our immediate task is to absolutely go all out to prevent Trump and the Republicans and the right wing from stealing the elections through all kinds of chicanery. We've seen voter fraud as well. So that's our first step. And then we need to, of course, talk about how we are going to really build mass movements to defeat Trump and to defeat Trumpism.
Mm. Oh, I hear you, my dear sister. I mean, that's part of the anti-fascist coalition that has to stay in place now that the voting has already taken place. But what happens if Trump actually ends up with more votes? I mean, we still have to have an anti-fascist coalition, but it still says something about just how sick and blind so many of our fellow citizens are, and their contempt for neoliberal rule is intense, but it doesn't move to the left. It moves to the right. So that what happens is the crisis of the neoliberal rule is now just undeniable. There's just no doubt about that. It's hollowed out. It's shallow. Is vacuous, and yet they still were a major impediment against America's march to fascism. That's why many of us still promoted at least voting for Biden. But now it is very clear that it's so close, but Trump can still actually win. What happens if he actually has more votes? What do we do then?
I think the question already that we're facing, I mean, if Trump was to actually win, then of course this question that you've raised, Brother Dr. West, becomes the most palpable. But even now, yeah. The fact that we are in a close race itself is evidence enough for why we should be discussing this point about you know, what is the way forward? And I would say, of course, that obviously there is a current of reactionary ideology of right-wing ideas. We, of course, don't want to have a romanticized view of America. But look, the reality is, of course, that the vast majority of American people, working people, are completely angry at the system. And as you said, the legitimacy of the main parties, both the corporate parties, is at an all-time low. What has been missing, though, is not that ordinary people don't understand that it's not in their interest to vote against Trump. What's been missing is an actual alternative to the Republican and the Democratic parties. I mean, there's been enormous potential for a new party for a working class, like a party that is accountable to working people, that is independent of the billionaire class. That potential was visible with the electrifying response that Bernie got to his campaign. But look at the historic setback from him capitulating in the way that he did to the Biden campaign and to the Democratic Party. And as Brother Dr. West, you yourself have said, while Ocasio-Cortez and now Cori Bush are crucial voices, and I agree with them on many, many issues that they have spoken up, and I really value their voices, they're still, as you said, locked inside a party that is simply not presenting a path forward for working people and the oppressed and the poor. I mean, who will represent the vast constituency of people who want to fight for the things that Bernie was calling for? You know, a real battle against Wall Street, to fund, to make universities free by taxing Wall Street, for Medicare for all, to ending student debt. Brianna was just talking about the massive burden of student debt. I mean, it is an abdication of responsibility on the left if we don't actually provide an alternative to represent them. And I'll say it even more clearly, who will represent the over 20 million young people who just months ago made history on the streets of America in the multiracial working class movement against racism and police violence? But not just that, the George Floyd protest really captured something much deeper in the consciousness of tens of millions of working people and young people, which is a complete disenchantment with the system itself and a search for a new way forward. So there's a real potential to build something outside of the Democratic Party, but it's not something that can stay in the abstract. It has to be an actual thing that we work for. And I'll just make a few more points. I mean, for the political pundits who say that it's too risky to begin to build a new party, that we have to settle for either of the Democrats or Republicans who represent the capitalist system, look how risky it has been to have a candidate like Biden. Look how risky it was to run somebody like Hillary Clinton, which is what gave rise to the Trump presidency, the con man that took office. And tonight could have been a straightforward victory against a failed president. And now we are going to spend this night in tremendous anxiety. And also I'll say, for those who say we cannot have independent left candidates at the federal level, but you know, we should do it in municipal races, I can tell you, I've been in office as an outspoken socialist, not running within the Democratic Party, for 7 years nearly on the city council. I'm one socialist. There's 8 Democrats on the council. There's no danger of Republicans. And yet we have faced attack after attack from the Democratic establishment and from big business. In fact, right now, my council office is facing a recall attempt by big business and the right wing. So my point being that, yes, it will be difficult. Yes, there will be threats against any attempt to capture the anger that millions of people are facing. And the system and its representatives will always tell us, don't do that. It's not going to work. But we cannot afford to listen to them. You know, all the way from the climate crisis to the pandemic to the recession, we cannot afford to wait.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I hear you, my sister. I hear you, my dear sister. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are way out of time, I've been hearing in my ear. So this was a very powerful final segment around, you know, really what we need to, how we need to think about it and what the boundaries are and what are the costs of the sacrifices. So, Connie, I don't know if you had a final word very quickly. I know we didn't get back to you as I was hoping, but maybe you just give us a final word and then we'll be able to go to Christian Scott, who's going to play us out and give us some beautiful, soulful, thoughtful, reflective, brilliant music to help us make it to, you know, past midnight and maybe all the way to Friday. But Connie, did you have something you wanted to say real quick before we sign off on our
show? Yeah. Buckle up, because the hand-to-hand combat is about to start. Mm-hmm. And the lawyers are poised to,
they're locked,
we're ready
and loaded
to go into court, locked and loaded. So we got to get through this election. If we don't put a floor underneath the disintegration and the corruption, we'll have nothing to work with. So I've got my eye on that.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
No,
indeed.
No, for good reason.
Thank you.
For good. Well, we are, with the two of y'all, we ended on a high note, and now we move to the musical notes of Brother Christian himself. It's been a wonderful night. Wonderful night.
Yes, it has. It has.
Wonderful night in dialogue. It's been a grim night in terms of the reality.
Yeah.
Of what we're up against.
Well, thanks for that clarification. It was like, oh man, it was rough. Yes, indeed. Yes, it was wonderful to be with you both. Thank you again. And Connie, thank you for coming back. And Kashama, we'll have you, hopefully we'll
Absolutely.
See you again too.